goddamn is this book about abstinence an absolute banger. Hello, and welcome to The Feminist Present, the podcast where we use the gift of feminism to think about, talk about, and wrestle with what's happening right now. I am Laura Good.
And I'm Adrian Dobb.
And today we are fangirling on friend of the pod, returning guest,
yes,
Melissa Phoebos, who has a new book, The Dry Season, coming out in the first week of June. And goddamn is this book about abstinence an absolute banger, as Adrian put it.
It is paradoxically...
It is paradoxically sexy.
Yeah, very sexy, very wise. A tour de force. I mean, you wouldn't expect anything less from Melissa Phoebos, but here it is.
She's so good at like regulating her nervous system and then writing about it. It's like the depth and the ambition of the psychological journeys that her books take us on are always very striking to me.
Yeah, and we should say that it's, you know, the book is already, we're recording this slightly early, but the book's already attracting a lot of attention. We're guessing that a lot of people are going to ask other questions and maybe better questions down the line. But
we get to be first.
We get to be first, which least. Is always exciting and kind of its own sort of pleasure. Sometimes, you know, just to talk a little bit about how the sausage is made. The vegan sausage is made on this particular podcast.
It's like sausage would be an ironic metaphor to choose
how
here.
How the Beyond Meat is made. you know, when you prepare for something like this, you do listen to an author's podcast appearances, public speaking, the kind of work they put out to promote their book, just so you don't kind of cover the same thing that they've already been asked. And with the book like this, we don't get to do it because we know her well. We got early access to it and it's very exciting. And we get to go into it just kind of sort of, well, not virginally, but, you know, re-virginized or something. And it's nice, you know, it's nice to get to engage with a book, kind of just as a reader, first, and to sort of like not know much. I didn't know that much. But I knew the outlines of it, but like I was picking it up and I was like, all right, let's go on this journey. And it's always a wonderful thing.
Oh, it's a book that is like much more than meets the eye. I mean, I think one could write a book one quarter this interesting on just like a year of not dating or having sex. And then Melissa like really expands that lens. It was just occurring to me that this is her fifth work of nonfiction. And like, you would think that for some people, the memoiristic well would sort of run dry at some point, but Melissa's books are all, I've read them all, and they're all so different. Certainly they circle around a lot of the same themes of feminism and consent and agency and all of this, but each of them is so unique. And I really appreciated the dive into this one. Like you can read, one of the things I love about that body of work is you can read the author maturing and gaining insight and information that she didn't have previously. Yeah. And I think that's true both of her oeuvre as a whole and of this book individually.
Yeah. And, you know, longtime followers of this podcast probably don't need a explicit reminder what these books are, but just in case you're kind of joining us a little late,
yes,
in which case, explore the back catalog.
Welcome.
It's fun. Welcome.
Yes.
We love you. The books are, I think, in order, Whip Smart, which came out in 2009, 2010. Abandon Me.
Yep, 2017.
Girlhood and
2021.
Bodywork, which is the one that we interviewed her about last time.
Yes, which is in some ways, I mean, it's so interesting. You could easily compare any of those two works, but Bodywork is an exploration primarily of literary ethics and of the craft of creative nonfiction. And The Dry Season 2 is an exploration of the nature of narrative and the nature of consent, you know, and all of this stuff. So the way the threads interweave, I think, is what makes the experience of reading Melissa Phoebos so rewarding and magical.
Yeah. And maybe with that, we should just let people explore. Well, follow along as we talk to Melissa Phoebos and then explore their own relationship to this topic, maybe in a bubble bath, maybe with some candles.
Yes, definitely always read about horny nuns. Whenever offered the opportunity to research horny nuns, always say yes.
Yeah, this is a great book to read in a nunnery if you have a local one that you frequent. You're like, hey, ladies.
That should be a listicle that we make.
Nobody bother me. I'm reading Melissa Phoebos.
10 books to take with you to the nunnery. Oh, yeah. That's what we're making here on The Feminist Present. Anyway, please enjoy this interview with the brilliant and wonderful Melissa Phoebos, and please keep tuning in as we try to figure out what the hell is going on.
Right now.
I need to narrate for the reader the thickness of post-it notes yeah. that I'm delivering on Melissa Phoebos' The Dry Season. I have Melissa, we're going to be here for 5 hours. Lock in.
I love it. I love it. You know, being annotated is like my love language.
Yes,
so
of course.
I'm so happy. Like sticky tabs, marginal notes. There's no sincerer form of flattery.
I mean, one thing about me, Melissa, is if you give me this much data on horny nuns, there will be annotations. Guarantees do exist in the world, and that is one of them.
And that's why we're kindred spirits.
That's right. Also, you quote Audre Lorde's uses of the erotic in every one of your works, and every time I'm like, God damn, here for it. She did it again. Like, it's always relevant.
I'll keep doing it. I do it in most essays, too. I'm just like, if you haven't read this, if you're reading me, and you haven't read this, you are not doing your homework.
It is also just a literal banger.
It's a literal banger. I told my feminist life writing class last fall, I was like, this is our odyssey. Like everything we do starts here. Okay, so I have so many comments on this book, but one of the things that really surprised and delighted me about it is a book about abstinence. Like I would love to hear you recap the book at some point, but I actually think it is your sexiest work yet. Like it was very sexy. The exploration of the nature of ecstasy was super sexy. The affirmation horny nuns and like things they possibly might have done in history, super sexy. But also just this frisson of withholding, of like of examining your own attraction to transgression without doing it, mm-hmm. was like by definition sort of a condition of longing, which is so sexy.
Yeah.
So. I don't know what were the questions. Was that your intention? Was that something that surprised you too? Like, tell us about your entry point into that.
Oh, this is so gratifying. I just cannot tell you how satisfying it is to hear this because, you know, I've started having conversations about the book, but I haven't had very many yet. And so, and probably none of them with someone who is more an ideal reader than like you hosts of this podcast. Yeah, I'm just so glad that that was your reading experience. And, you know, in the beginning, it was not my intention. I was actually extremely worried that there wasn't going to be enough tension in this book. And I was like, how do I write a book about being happy for a year? I was like, so stressed that there wasn't going to be enough narrative tension and that I was going to have to import it. And I thought of all these things and I thought there was going to be 10 times as much research because the researcher was going to have to stand in the place of the narrative conflict. And then I started actually recounting that year and did figure out like pretty quick, not super quickly, but somewhat quickly that just what you're saying, that the exercise of abstinence, of resistance, of withholding from a kind of pursuit and climax, so to speak, is the enactment of Eros, right? That it was exactly that the whole thing is predicated on tension related to sex and wanting and not having. And so it was actually sort of baked into the very premise of the book. And then, you know, it was beautiful because that then freed me up where I didn't have to do like structural backflips or research backflips. I could actually just follow the story and my own interest and figure out what felt organically relevant to me.
Right. I mean, it's like it's baked into the concept. And at the same time, the Melissa narrator who exists at the beginning of this book could never have known that it would be a story of Eros. Mm-hmm. And so the mm-hmm. reader goes, you take the reader on this journey of realizing that Eros is what you're holding without touching anybody yeah. else's skin. And that was wild. Yeah. I mean, to me, the three animating pillars of the tension that you were seeking to enact, that you were describing, were number one, the research, the horny nuns, which we will return to. Number two, what you're learning about yourself through observing these relationships you have with other people, you know, like the 25-year-old mm-hmm. who's kind of mm-hmm. chasing you and the friend who's going through the really messy extended mm-hmm. breakup, like all of those are mirrors. Mm-hmm. And then also just like your own journey of learning to delight in solitude, which is a really hard thing to narrativize. I mean, masturbation absolutely holds a place in that. I love when you write about masturbation, Melissa. This isn't the first time you've written about masturbation.
No, it's not the second or the third time either, it turns out.
But tell me about what you learned about ecstasy through the pursuit of experiencing the events that became this book and writing this book.
Oh, God. I guess it's interesting because there's this sort of idea that I want to say flirt. I'm just going to be so aware of all my metaphors and how charged they are, but that I sort of tangle with in this book and that I did that year, which is the idea of addiction and how my experiences in romance and sex, particularly in romance and like the pursuit, seduction, the kind of dance of it and attachment, they map on to the rubric of addiction in some ways, but not in all ways. And one of the sort of animating questions of that year as I was living it was, am I a love and sex addict? Like, is this that problem?
And you reckon with that quite seriously. Yeah.
Yeah. And can it be addressed with that solution? And the answer was like, kind of, spoiler alert, the answer is kind of a little bit, but not entirely. And anyway, what I'm getting at in a very circuitous way is that when a person is focused on one source of pleasure or what we think of as ecstasy, like a way of getting outside oneself or of sort of moving deeper into oneself and moving into another plane of sort of consciousness, when you're focused on one source of that to the exclusion of whatever else is happening or whatever other opportunities for experience are in your life, it's actually a contraction, right? Mm-hmm. It's a thrill, but it's very repetitive and it doesn't progress. It's a repetition, right? And when an abstinence in that state feels like, oh God, it's like turning off the TV when I was a kid, like, oh, there'll be nothing left to live for. Like, it's my one thrill in life and I'm going to take it away. So I will exist in like a dreary vacuum, a dreary, pleasureless, laughterless vacuum. I guess if I must, I will do that. But in fact, what happens is you turn off the TV and then you become aware of like all of life, right? And there's this analogy that I use in the book that occurred to me during that year. And then I sort of had in my back pocket, I didn't know where I was going to put it in the book, of like looking at a single room through a keyhole and feeling like that was your route to everything. And then you turn around and like the whole world is behind you, right? Like everything is behind you. And I've had this experience so many times, like a ridiculous number of times. And so in a way, what I describe in this book is the experience again and again of sort of turning around, further turning around, and the sort of microwaves that I was trying to peer through a keyhole at something when actually I could just turn around and face so many other more vivid lived versions of it.
Yes, that gets to one of the things that I was thinking about as I was reading, which is in this act of locating the courage to walk in a different direction, the nature of what you're leaving behind also changes. You know, like to pick up your metaphor of like the binging on TV, which I also do like every day of my life, you know, you step away and then you're like, that show was horrible. And there was a plot hole there. And I'm basically traumatizing myself by watching this violence again. And this thing that I thought I could never let go of is actually bad for me.
Yeah.
And that is mirrored in, I mean, what you're efforting towards is walking towards real devotion, like real authenticity. Mm-hmm. And in that pivot, you realize that a lot of what you're walking away from was not real devotion and real authenticity. Mm-hmm. I was really struck by, I have to read a passage on 153 where you're talking about like childhood girlfriend relationships. And the way young women like profess this eternal devotion to each other that can't possibly manifest, which I related to so much. On some inchoate level, we knew these professions weren't true. It was a performance, a transaction not of divulged truth, but of emotional comfort. I was given the pleasure of feeling necessary and worshipped, and I paid for this with the promise of devotion. There was pleasure also in the theater of it. I think that's the first time you use the word theater in the book. And that word really jumped out at me, because of course it's theater. What, like 14-year-old girls, we don't know that it's theater. We don't know that there's an alternative. But so much of what you are turning away from is actually like a theater of devotion instead of real devotion, right?
And I think in some ways, like, that's so astute of you. And as you're talking, I'm like, right. And maybe in a way, dependency is always a theater of real attachment, right? Where it's like an addiction is a theater of like desire, right? Where it's like, oh no, I want this thing. And I'm going to chase it. And then we're going to run this scene again. You know, we're going to do it again and do it again and do it again. But it doesn't ever go anywhere. And it never lasts. You have to do it again and again and again to experience it. Yes. Right. When actual attachment, because you're not grasping and grasping at this thing that you can't actually possess, you're never satisfied, right? It's like I quote an old therapist of mine saying, you can't get enough of a thing you don't need. It's just endless hunger, right? When actual attachment and actual devotion is full of agency, you choose it choices. Again and again and again. You don't yield to it again and again and again. It's much harder, in fact, because it's not sucking you in. You have to actually step toward it. You have to make that choice. You have to be in possession of your faculties. And that's why it's meaningful, right? Because you're not in bondage. You're actually devoting yourself to something.
Totally.
So the question of theatricality, I think, raises also, like, on the one hand, I think it's a really good thing to bring in as an, you know, to sort of describe what you're trying to kind of disentangle yourself from. At the same time, it's very noticeable that the book itself is pretty anti-theatrical, or not particularly theatrical, it seems to me. Compared to, like, you draw very clearly on a lot of sort of feminist and especially lesbian feminist thought from the 70s, and you point out that there's this like visionary quality to that. And the book kind of performs something much different, it seemed to me. It's something that's a lot more kind of a patient practice. And it's not to say that it's not political, but it's to say that its political interventions are far less sort of spectacular, or I guess I would have said like stagey. Does that make sense? Like there's a kind of praxis, you know, sort of a day-to-day kind of quality to it that I thought was both interesting and seemed kind of like a reply to like the sense like, hey, have we been here before? Right? You're like, well, not like that, we haven't. Can you say a little bit more about that? How did feminist foremothers kind of guide you? But to what extent is this book also like, hey, I'm going to try to do something a little bit different here?
Yeah, I love that. And I'm so glad that was your reading of it, Adrian. And it's a way I hadn't really thought about it in sort of the trajectory of my past works, but it makes perfect sense. And it really matches sort of my experience of writing it, where I think I'm a more integrated and nuanced and confident writer and feminist than I ever have been before, which we hope is the trajectory through time, but isn't always the case. And I think in my earlier books, sometimes you need theatricality to land the idea or the resolution to be like, you need a running start, you know, you need a costume and a cast and some music so that you can like stick the landing and say the thing or like really find kind of arrive in an idea. And I think in this book, it's not even different feminist thoughts than I've had before or different thinkers than I've sort of used as lenses in my work, but it was a much more organic way of applying them and a much more sort of, I guess like practical or lived experience, you know, where I was addressing the messy, intimate, somewhat embarrassing kind of everyday interactions with people, which is often where ideology fails, right? It's much easier to write a manifesto than it is to behave differently in relationship with other people. Oof. And to build a fresh set of instincts that you can react differently. Yeah. Like that's the real test, I think, of like a raised consciousness is in the moment, are you reacting differently than you did in the past? And how do you install that into your own thinking? And I think my previous books and my previous readings of these feminists were about trying to figure out that process. And this book is more about enacting that process, right? Yes. Of saying, okay, I figured out what the process looks like pretty much. Here's a new area where I need to address it. Like, oh shit, I lifted up a new log. Here are some bugs. These bugs came from the same tree that those other bugs came from. I'm going to use some tools. I'm going to go back to these texts and I'm going to try to apply it here. And I'm going to improvise more than I have in the past because I've done these kinds of processes before, just not in this area, not with this particular arrangement of factors, right? Does that make sense?
Yeah. That brings me back to the, we'll call it like a light sobriety framework that encircles the book. I agree with your conclusion that like this is not a book about love and sex addiction, but that the principles of sobriety are useful to helping you understand and the reader understand. Like one of the things that it seems the mile markers that you place in the book narratively of how we know that you've changed internally, I thought were really striking and beautiful. And one that I deeply related to was when you tried to return to the service industry and couldn't because you had worked and taught and been treated with respect before.
Yep.
Like,
yep.
God damn. I mean, what I think is narratively interesting about that is how the pull towards authenticity in your personal life, in your sexual life, is now bleeding into a demand for that same kind of respect and recognition in your professional life. And also, I'm just a person who has been both a bartender and a professor. And like, you know, I got to Stanford and I was like, this is literally the first job where I haven't been sexually harassed in my entire life. You know, like I'm 41 years old. That shouldn't be astonishing. And yet it is. Mm-hmm. So the moment when you collect a lot of tips on the service floor, and then the cook yells at you, are you fucking stupid or something? It's like, no, I don't do that any. Like, we're not doing that any. That just seemed like a really important mile marker of self-respect to me.
Thank you. And it's so true. That's so interesting to think about those mile markers because I can instantly think of other ones in the book too. And those are the moments, right? Like change and changing yourself willfully is such a muddy process. It's so hard to know if you're doing it right. And you just don't know for a long time. You just sort of muddle along reading the feminists and like talking to your friends and writing your little essays. And like, and then one day you're like, oh no, actually I am not capable of tolerating that kind of treatment. Something has shifted. Or a hot 25-year-old is like, and you're like, actually no. That's the wrong thing to do. And knowing that is enough for me to not do it this time.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
And subtler moments too. Like another mile marker that appears to me is, well, it's kind of bifurcated. One, when you learn the term rain check, and two, when you decide to set rain checks aside, like on your, what is a rain check in the frame of this book?
So a rain check in the frame of this book is, basically a person, a sexual or romantic prospect that you are keeping on the line. You're keeping on the back burner. You're like, not today, but maybe tomorrow. And you're maintaining that undercurrent of flirtation in case you ever want to cash it in.
Yeah. And that, like, that wasn't a term that I understood in this framework until I read this book either. And I like read that and looked behind my shoulder. I was like, oh shit. Oh, I can totally see why that's like a function of codependency. I can totally see why that's like a hunger for validation that's just sort of like stirring in the background. Moving past that felt really important, and defining that felt really important.
Yeah, exactly. And like all of the other mechanisms of codependency and, you know, compulsory heterosexuality and all of the, you know, nasty stuff, of course, its long-term effects are the exact opposite of its short-term effects, right?
Exactly.
It's like, it's a short-term payout for a short-term payoff for a long-term payout, right? Where you're, let's just see how many analogies I can fit in there. But in the short term, having rain checks makes you feel like you have options. You're never alone if there's someone you could
call. You're never unwanted.
You're always wanted. Anytime you need that short-term validation, you can just click that line and it'll quiver in the right way and make you feel good. And in the long term, for me, it profoundly undermined my self-esteem because it felt like nobody ever saw me or actually loved me or actually connected. It absolutely precluded true connection with other people because what we were doing, it was like we were sharing a cigarette instead of having a conversation. You know what I mean? And in that way, yeah, it's like, this is how the sort of like the rubric of addiction is so helpful, where it's like when I was drinking and using all those years and I had so many great friends and the main point of our connection was our using and our drinking. And underneath that feeling of connection or that illusion or theater of connection was actually the deep suspicion and belief that they didn't care about me at all. And in a lot of cases, it was true.
I mean, a couple of minutes ago, you used the word yield, and then Adrian used the word visionary, and all of that catapulted me back to the horny and probably queer nuns, which I feel like we have to talk about. So I began by saying this is, I think, your sexiest book yet. I think it's also easily your most spiritual book yet. And I think those threads are very intertwined. I'm going to read a little bit more from the text. The female mystics claimed a desire to yield to the divine, to disperse their selfhood into the universe. And then you go on. The more I read about Hildegard von Bingen and other women who lived in devotion to God and seclusion from men, the more I saw it as a harbor for ambition. Imagine a woman rich in talent, possession of an exceptional mind, a woman who hungers for power and craves challenge. What hell for her to live in society where nothing is expected of her, nor indeed allowed, but to breed and cook and clean and otherwise care for men who are her inferiors. It's remarkable you've never been married to a man and yet you wrote that sentence. Tell me about your communion with these mystics. Like, tell me about the ways in which you love and drew from these divine women.
Oh my God. I just could talk about this for the rest of my life. And I assume that I will.
Girl, same. Yes.
So, you know, when I started researching female celibacy, I was like, I had sort of realized that I needed to trade in some of my role models because I'd had these role models that were convenient to the behavior that I was trying to stop. So yep. Women who were amazing artists, but were like super messy and probably pretty compulsive in their love lives, like yep. Colette, Edna St. Vincent Millay. And so I was like, all right, I'm just going to start working my way into like famous female celibates, voluntary celibates, right? Not weird Vestal Virgin type shit. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, medieval mystics and nuns, like I got to pretty quickly. And, you know, I mean, I don't know about you, but I had always sort of fantasized about nuns fucking each other. I think most queer
who doesn't
like women intellectuals do.
That's normal. Yeah,
it's like a bunch of women living together, doing fetishy Catholic shit. Like, yes, and definitely some of them were like Benedicta. I don't know if you saw that movie. Danica left the theater. She was like, it's too much. So there definitely were nuns who were fucking each other, but that wasn't the great revelation of my reading about them. Like pretty quickly in reading about these nuns, and there were a lot of medieval nuns, also the Beguines, who I could talk about forever, who weren't nuns. Oh, yeah. They were a sect of religious lay women who sort of modeled themselves on nuns, but were not ruled over by men of the church. And definitely a bunch of Catholics. Was that the ones at least that we know about today, we know about because they were incredibly powerful, because they were politicians, they were artists. In the case of Hildegard, they were writers.
Yeah.
And in fact, it was a great tradition of nuns to write, now I'm forgetting what the Latin word is it for it is. But it was like part of the tradition of being a nun, especially in the Benedictine tradition, to write your story, to write your autobiography.
Lectio Divina.
Lectio Divina.
Yes.
To basically write your memoir, to write your spiritual memoir. And, you know, and then like Catherine of Siena, Hildegard, all of these women were incredibly powerful politicians. Like the church was actually a place where they could ascend the hierarchy. The ceiling just wasn't as low as it was everywhere. I mean, it was like on the floor socially, but in terms of the church, there were routes for them, and they were incredibly savvy, incredibly politic, incredibly lots of like palace intrigue, like manipulations, yeah. But they could exercise those talents and find a pathway to exercise all of their other talents, be it like scientific, frequently artistic, which is part of why I connected with them so much, and sometimes erotic, like the absolute pornography that I read while researching this book, that these nuns wrote about Jesus and his foreskin. I mean, true, grisly, dirty, fantastical shit, like really, really amazing. And it was, they were just more pious, right? And the same way it was like, I think I first started, my brain first started like fizzing about this when I was reading about saints, about sainthood, and the way that young medieval girls of a certain class would learn about the sainted women, and they would start competing. The way you read about child athletes, like child figure skaters, these little girls very clearly to me would be like, oh, wow, that is my one path out of this hellscape. And they would start starving themselves, proclaiming that they were having visions, whipping themselves with nettles. Like yep. It was like dog eat dog out there, because they being sainted was literally the only way that you could like lead a self-actualized life.
So wild.
I could just keep going forever. I mean,
oh my God.
I was just like, me and all my friends, me and Laura, my mom, like, this is what we would have been whipping ourselves with nettles and on hunger strike.
Oh, absolutely.
Because there's just, I would perish. 100%. I can't even work in a fucking office, let alone be like a breeding chattel, you know? Like, it just, I would definitely have been like, tithe me to the church. You must.
I am having a vision. There is a vision That's happening right. right now. I mean, I two thoughts. One, I LOL'd really hard when you wrote, I found Catholicism the most erotic of the Christian traditions. The Catholic lovers I'd had were the most insane by far, but they were also sexual savants. I was like, well, that's what Catholic school will do to you. But like on a more somber note, like what I found really like historically moving within the frame of gender studies and like the history of gender was your interview in Italy with, who was it? Silvana Panciera, who mm-hmm. was writing about the sort of original feminism of these Beguines. Mm-hmm. And you write, though it was fairly easy to find the texts of the most famous Beguine mystics, I understood that they were famous because their texts had survived. We would never know the names of most because their legacy had been destroyed. And mm-hmm. I was just like, God damn, the power of writing something down, you know, like it's yep. so as we are under yep. active threat by the government right now, mm-hmm. you know, like that was mm-hmm. a very cherished reminder of the value of historicizing through yeah. writing things down and what an impact Absolutely. That can have centuries later.
It's so important. And, you know, it was also like, what a god shot to be reading, to spend 5 years reading about these women in the on ramp to this particular moment.
Totally. Totally.
Because the Beguines, and this is like not even to speak of the, you know, what other nuns went through, but the Beguines, so this independent sect of religious lay women who basically right. like formed their own collectives, lived collectively, were financially independent, preached. They were radical ladies. A lot of them were artists. Right. They worshiped through ecstatic dance and music. Like they were incredible. You know, when the church found out how free they were, those guys, of course, were like, absolutely not.
Nope. No,
and
no, no.
Started persecuting them, literally burning them as heretics. Did the Beguines stop? Did they even go underground? No, no. It was like, I think Marguerite Perret, who wrote The Mirror of Simple Souls, who's one of these like one of the names we know of whose text has survived, was like shouting about it at the stake. You know, like they did not stop dancing. They did not stop painting. They did not stop writing their Lectio Divina. They did not stop preaching, even though it was illegal for women to be preaching. They absolutely still experienced probably erotic joy and pleasure, certainly spiritual joy and pleasure. And they right. worked in mutual aid and service to their communities. And like, fortunately, we're not back there yet. Like, we're actually a far cry from being.
Thank God. Yes.
I'm wondering, in terms of your investigations into these medieval nuns, is there an element here of, what's the communal? So like there's a lot of sort of mystical, a lot of kind mm-hmm. of return to the self, et cetera, et cetera. But of course, the other thing that we're always talking about when we talk about these medieval nunneries is, of course, it was also a way for women to interact in ways that sort of felt broader, not just to actualize mm-hmm. their own selfhood, but to actualize it sort of in a group, yep. communally. How much community is in your book? How much community did this effort of yours, basically, how much community was it able to constitute?
Yeah, thank you so much for bringing that up, Adrian. So central to the way I think about this book. And you know, the Beguines had this term that was really sort of central to their thinking and living and their ethos, which was all for all, right? And they used the words God and love interchangeably. Like, they capitalized love, and sometimes they would write God, sometimes they'd write Lord, and sometimes they would just write love. But at the center of their sort of spiritual belief system was this idea of divine love. And the way that divine love is expressed is through communal love, through communal aid and communal love, right? And so they were very service oriented. They were very sort of democratic and somewhat socialist in some ways, in the ways that their communities oriented. Like, there was sort of a mother figure at the Beguinage, but she wasn't necessarily a ruler. She was more of a leader, right? And I think this ended up feeling so central to me while I was writing the book, because one of the trajectories narratively in this experience, both in sort of the living of the year that I describe in the dry season, but also in the writing of it, it really crystallized in the writing of it, was that it is a kind of love story, but the mm-hmm. but the lover in the book is not a physical lover. It's my community. It's friendship, right? It's it is sort of something that aligns much more accurately with that idea of like capital L love, of like divine love. And in fact, romantic love, as I could conceive of it at the end of that year, my sort of new ideal that I came up with was a kind of romantic love that could fit inside of that conception, that was an extension of it rather than something that would compete with it, right? And in the past, my experience of romantic and sexual love was that it was something that always competed with the other loves of my life, and that I often sort of chose to the detriment of those other relationships, to my friendships, my community, my activism, my students, my service in my recovery communities. Like, you know, it was such a pattern. I would fall in love and I would just neglect everything else. And there was this painful tension I would have to navigate again and again, where I felt like I had to choose. And by the end of this year, I was like, no romantic love that is right for me, that aligns with my belief, that is an example of the Lordian version of the erotic, is going to be in competition with the other things that make my life meaningful, right? And yeah, and at the end, you know, I remember when I was reading through like the first full draft of the book, and I got to the end of it, and I saw those lines of friendship and how the other main characters in the book were my friends, you know? And I thought, oh, this is a love story, right? This is a story about falling in love with my community, right? And relocating that focus to something that was sustainable, that was a form of mutual aid and nurturance.
Interdependent instead of codependent.
Right. And it's also like, duh, it's like basic feminism. It's like feminism 101, which is like where I always end up, you know?
But it's a lot easier. Like, it's a lot easier to read and even write than it is to live, as you in this book point yeah. out. I mean, one of the things that what you were just saying about this book being an exploration of love, it also seems to investigate what is contained within love. Like, what are love's tenets, right? Which really come to fruition in the list at the end of the book about like sort of yeah. your sobriety rules for engaging with love and relationships.
Yeah.
But a word that loomed really large in this path navigation for me was responsibility. Mm-hmm. And you use the word responsible in two places that really jumped out at me. One, let me summarize. You're talking about a lover that you did not move forward with, the woman that you met at a conference, and you mm-hmm. stepped away from that interaction. And then later she apologizes for it and apologizes for her behavior. Mm-hmm. And you write, "I could hardly believe it. I wanted to collapse at her feet with gratitude. She chose not to blame me, but to take responsibility for her own part. She hadn't needed mm-hmm. 9 months of celibacy and a confession of her life's romantic exploits to do so either." I loved that passage. And then a little antenna pinged in my brain. I was like, responsibility is a word that has come up before in this book. And the previous time that it comes up is when you're describing hooking up with a professor when you're in college, and then reflecting mm-hmm. on that as an adult. And you write, "No matter how demoralized, I could not imagine fingering an undergrad in the back of a cab. I knew that no student of mine, no matter how seductive, could have made a victim of me. I would always have been the one responsible." Mm-hmm. So like with those two examples in mind and anything else, like how does the concept of responsibility factor in here for you?
Oh my God, this is such a smart question. I think it's really at the crux of what needed to change, right? So like the way I see sort of changing behavior is like, you have to get clarity on what's been happening, and you have to get clarity on your part in it. What have you been doing that is producing the results? It's about
right, which taking, is also a sobriety framework. Yeah,
right, exactly. And it's like, you have to like reflect, you have to take the inventory, look at what's happening, and then you have to like be willing to accept your part in it, right? And then you can think about what you can do differently. Like, changing is an empowered position. You have to empower yourself by looking at your role in things and yes. accepting that most of what happens in human life is the consequence of ours and other people's actions. Things don't just happen to us. You know, we do stuff and it's part of a chain of cause and effect, right? And so for me, there was this huge turning point when I sort of made this long, demoralizing inventory of all my past relationships, which was incredibly tedious in its repetition. And the main takeaway, and it became clear to me really, really quickly, was that I had not been taking responsibility for my own behavior in relationships. I had been like, why does this always keep happening?
Yes.
What I should have been saying is like, why do I keep doing this over and over again? You know, which is like, so much at the center of what I see as our kind of collective derangement, like collective yeah, meaning like course. In this country, in this culture, in this, you know, in a lot of this world, especially the Western world, where we're like, I just need to find the right guy, you know? And it's like, do you, or do you need to figure out what you're doing and why you're choosing the wrong guy over and over or whatever, you know, like that's a real reductive, mm-hmm. But basically what I'm saying, anyway, so I looked at the inventory and it was almost immediately clear to me that I had been doing the same things over and over and over again. And most of it was, I had not been taking responsibility for the ways that I was like manipulating and compromising and using other people, in the same way that I have used television and cigarettes and candy and heroin and to get a feeling, you know. Even, you know, there's a line I quote from a mentor of mine in the book that is, people pleasing is people using. And
I had to lay down, Melissa. Oh my God.
Yes. Isn't it awful? I just about pooped my pants when they said that to me. I was like, no, because it's too true. It's like, people pleasing is manipulating other people so that I can feel safe. That's what it is. It's very selfish. That was a rough one. But so helpful because
totally. Thank God for that mentor.
Then, because there are things you can do after that. If you're just working yeah. and working, trying to care for other people, and it keeps going wrong, and you're helpless, like what can you do? Nothing. You're helpless. You're a victim. You just keep suffering. But if you are trying to manipulate other people, you can stop. and you can take responsibility for your own behavior. And so then I knew what to do next. Not that it was easy, mm-hmm. but I had a course of action.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to throw in a, just because of what you just said about the way we discover that things that happen to us are to some extent things that we do to ourselves or that we mm-hmm. attract to ourselves. Mm-hmm. I wanted to read a brief passage that this reminded me of and get your sort of read out where this is in the book, because I don't think it's there. And I think that's for good reason, but I wanted to sort of maybe elucidate that contrast for our listeners. So I'm just going to read this. It's a little long, but thus, one knows people with whom every human relationship ends in the same way. Benefactors whose proteges, however different they may otherwise have been, invariably after a time desert them in ill will, so that they are apparently condemned to drain all the dregs of bitterness of ingratitude. Men with whom every friendship ends in the friend's treachery. Others who indefinitely often in their lives invest some other person with authority either in their own eyes or generally themselves overthrow such authority after a given time only to replace it by a new one. Lovers whose tender relationships with women each and all run through the same phases and come to the same end and so on. That's Sigmund Freud on the repetition compulsion in Beyond the Pleasure Principle. And he's talking about himself.
Yeah,
like those are his
obviously.
Relationships. He's like, why did Jung leave me the same way that like Fleece left me, right? Like he's being like, that's his dry season. He's like, oh shit, this is Sigmund all along. Yep. It's been Sigmund all along.
Yep.
But so I, on the one hand, like read some book called Beyond the Pleasure Principle. So he's not saying, oh, this is just our own libido that's doing it. He's like, there's something else that's tugging at us here. And that's the scary part. Mm-hmm. Like I am not having a good time. And that's mm-hmm, the point. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, it does feel like you're touching at the same existential question, but psychoanalysis, I feel like, is pretty absent here, or is at least underplayed compared to. I feel like you go to the nunnery, so you don't have to go to Sigmund,
right.
basically. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but at the same time, it did strike me.
Yeah.
There's this real this real kinship in this question, like. Why again?
Mm-hmm. She was raised by a shrink. I mean, it seems like it's probably in the root system.
It's true. And I did, and I think that, you know, I've gone to it a lot in the past. Psychoanalysis somewhat, but psychology, psychotherapy, I've gone for psychological explanations more frequently than spiritual ones, probably, in my work. And, you know, I think it's like this, the repetition compulsion or sort of the, I don't know, dialectic of feeling sort of a victim or a free agent in your life. And are things happening to me or am I causing things or enacting things? You know, I think it definitely fits into the category of human experiences and questions and conflicts that have come up and are evidenced in our records as far back as, I mean, Montaigne was writing about this shit too. Plutarch was writing about this shit too.
Augustine
was writing about, you know, and so it just, and we can look at it through psychology. We can look at it through spirituality. We can look at it through, give me something else, you know, philosophy. We can probably look at it through science, through hard science, like neurology, game theory. I don't know. There's a lot of ways we have of describing it because we are, you know, as a species, we like to think of systems for describing things. And the things that are worth writing about, the writing that survives, that gets published, maybe certainly that survives history, is almost always naming those conditions, those universal mm-hmm. across time, class, gender, geography, they're human conditions. You know, the things, it's like, I actually write about this in Bodywork when I'm writing about sort of the analogic relationship between spiritual practices, creative practices, and psychological mm-hmm. practices and sort of trauma recovery, right? Where it's all sort of like, the nautilus in the shell, you know, it occurs everywhere in nature. You can pick any representation of it you want, but like, what is the lens that is going to be most fruitful to my aims here? And in this book, I didn't think that, you know, psychology is good for articulating how something got some way or what it is. And I wanted something bigger and more mystical. I didn't want to just state the problem correctly. I wanted a new way of looking forward, right? I wanted a way to move into the rest of my life with a different belief system, right? Which wasn't just about comprehension. It wasn't like a cognitive exercise. And I think I needed a spiritual solution. I didn't know that until I arrived at it. And I, you know, understood that that was my solution, but psychology couldn't quite fix it. The same way that psychology or therapy couldn't fix my addiction, you know, it could describe, it could articulate it, right? And it could talk about how I got there. It could name the pattern, but I actually needed a spiritual solution, and my spiritual solution comes through community usually. So like those things are very intertwined for me.
Yeah. I mean, I was thinking about how Freud was a cocaine addict, and I was also thinking about, you know, like maybe not the most reliable source on the spiritual solution, but I was also thinking about how the mandate to move towards the spiritual solution also requires a willingness and an ability to set down the habituation of capitalism. Oh. I feel I must blame capitalism in here. You know, like I was already talking about how much I related to your history in the service industry, for example. You write on 227, this gets back to what we were talking about a minute ago. The manner in which I had loved people was a symptom of how I moved through the world and understood my place in it. I had understood one of my life's tasks to be the management of others' perceptions of me. It was my job to attract them and then meet or placate their desires. I had performed this unconscious labor in every realm of social life. I had earned my living that way, my self-esteem and my physical safety. And I mean, this is a word salad I'm going to have to just walk my way through, but I just related so deeply to both the difficulty and the necessity of setting down the male gaze as a North Star, you know? Because it is so habituated, particularly in the service, when you are literally paying your rent through the male gaze and male desire, that is a really, really hard habit to unlearn. And I think this book is a document of learning, of unlearning it, you know, but I was just thinking about the literal muscle memory of knowing that you can survive and pay your rent and make your way in the world if only you are desired, you know, for the low, low price of being desirable until you die and then probably thereafter too. And there's a deep capitalist habituation. It's
exactly
hard.
And it's very, very recently in a historical context that love and sex and connection and marriage are not seen as largely a transactional exchange, right? And so of course we see that, but when I was talking about that shift and the responsibility, I mean, one way of describing that shift is going from looking at sex and love and romance as a transaction to an exchange, right? Or to something different, just a connection, right?
A collaboration
something else where we're not treating other people as either sort of like customers. Slot machine. Exactly. I already thought of the analogy.
That was your metaphor, not mine.
That's right. And women have for most of history been exchanging their bodies and their affections and the physical acts of care in exchange for their physical safety.
Exactly. It's such a short road from appearance to security.
Yeah. It doesn't, you know, it, even when that is not what's at stake, it still feels that way a lot of the time. It felt like to disappoint the people I was attracting or the people that I was connected, like it was life or death, right? Like I would be a little medieval peasant woman selling my body in the dirt streets if I disappointed them too much.
I mean, this connects so deeply and elegantly, I think, to your previous work on the nuances of consent. I'm thinking about the piece you wrote about the cuddle party and the moment in which Danica turns to you and is like, are you sure you're not people pleasing here? And you have to really check in with yourself about that. And I was just like, God damn, I'm so grateful she has a partner who's like that self-reflective and generative, to use Audre Lorde's word. But so much of this seems like an exploration of consent and a consent negotiation. And where does the boundary really authentically lay within me between what I truly want to do and what I think others might want me to do? Like that is the animating struggle of this book and of so much of your work, I think.
I am sorry to say that I suspect it never ends. it consent and my own sort of exploration and navigation and what is the word I'm looking for? I'm just like, I'm trying through so much of what I do in life to factor it down and to know myself so that I can consent as enthusiastically as possible, that it can be the truest form of consent. And I think it could always be truer. It's like there are just too many factors at work acting upon my own agency and my own feeling of safety that it just gets deeper and deeper and deeper, which is like, you know, a vexing thing to realize in some ways, but also it's a relaxing thing where it's like, all right, relax, you know, like settle in.
Nobody solves it. Yeah. There's
you're not
going to
solve
fix.
It. It's you're going to be doing this a long time. So just like enjoy yourself along the way. But because this book, as I was writing it, I felt like I was doing a kind of surgery on my own mind in some ways.
God, yes.
But now, you know, it's like I finished drafting it like over a year ago now. And I'm like, oh, once again, turns out it was actually the prologue to the real work. Like it actually just gets, you get a little respite where you're like, you know, I really did something there. And then you get to turn around and there's like another, you cross the finish line and there's another starting line just a few paces ahead. So it goes on.
Which is also a sobriety principle, right? Mm-hmm. Like setting down the thing that's harming you is only the beginning of the work that lays ahead in terms of changing behavior.
Oh, yeah. Or everybody's, you know, my favorite analogy, the onion, the layers of the onion, the cosmic onion that just never, you're just going to cry for infinity because that shit never ends. You just keep peeling and peeling.
Oh, cosmic fucking onion. Well, the book is The Dry Season, coming out in June.
Yeah, June 3rd.
June 3rd. The author is Melissa Phoebos, making her glorious return to the feminist present. Melissa, thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to talk to you about the intense pleasure of not having sex.
Oh my God. There's nothing more pleasurable than talking to you guys. It's the apex.
We'll come back soon.
I definitely will.
I've said the same thing myself.
The Feminist Present is a production of the Michelle R. Clayman Institute for Gender Research. The co-hosts are Adrian Daub and Laura Good. This podcast is produced by Ana de Almeida Almiral. We are especially grateful to our feminist colleagues, Allison Bell Crossley, Jennifer Portillo, Cynthia Newberry, Leah Gottlieb, Bethany J. Nichols, Jessica Lopez, Susan Krieger, Argavon Salas, and Moira Donegan.